FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next is the Gary Knoll Show. Please stay tuned.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
We have a power-packed program today. It's a deep dive day. Going to be sharing a lot of information and insights that can help you fully understand what the mainstream media has not allowed you to know. We'll share that information. I'll get to it in a few moments. But we always start with the latest on positive information about how we can all live a longer and healthier life if we make the right choices. For example, from the University of California, San Diego, comes a study published in the journal Clinical and Translational Science. It's about cacao, C-O-C-O-A, or chocolate, the raw chocolate. What does it do? It enhances skeletal muscle function. So this trial showed that persons with advanced heart failure and type 2 diabetes showed improved mitochondrial structure after 3 months of treatment with epicatechin, that's E-P-I-C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N, enriched cacao. And epicatechin is a flavonoid found in dark chocolate. So that's important because we're not talking about a lot of chocolate, maybe, well, 2 little squares a day off a chocolate bar. Make sure it's not a dairy chocolate, a milk chocolate, make sure it's not loaded with sugar, a healthy chocolate, somewhere around 70% cacao. So that is good for you. Because if you're one of these profoundly ill patients with major damage to your skeletal muscle, the mitochondria, then you benefit. What is the one thing when people are damaged and older that they lack? They lack energy. What gives you energy? Your mitochondria. What feeds the mitochondria? Anything that helps with the oxygenation of the tissue and protects the mitochondria. So stay away from that which is pro-inflammatory, coffee, which is highly anabolic, alcohol, fried foods. You know, we've gone over this a million times. Stay away from that and then put live foods in that are rich in nutrients, natural ORAC. Remember, at the end of the day, if we break it down piece by piece, what do we need? We need high ORAC, O-R-A-C. ORAC represents the total cumulative antioxidants. You eat an orange, you might get 30 to 50 milligrams of vitamin C. Okay, that's enough to prevent scurvy, but not a whole lot more. So if you think you're going to get your vitamin C by taking some vegetables and fruits each day, you're not. You're only getting minimal amounts. But so therefore we supplement. We take some vitamin C. That helps us, makes a big difference. Because most people are not aware, before you get to scurvy, you end up with subclinical scurvy, meaning you're not manifesting the symptoms, but you're getting there. It's like cancer. You don't have to have a big mass to be processing cancer for years, even decades. The same with clogging your arteries. Might take 30 years to clog your arteries before you have your stroke or heart attack or need a transplant. So the way that we do is we have to bring as many natural nutrients into our system that keep us from being deficient in any given nutrient. And we're all deficient, not all, but we're a largely deficient society in vitamin C, magnesium, in vitamin D, in zinc, four very important nutrients. So when you're doing something as simple as having just one item out of hundreds that you should be taking in, and you're diabetic, and about 100 million Americans are pre-diabetic or diabetic, then you're helping yourself at one level. It's one piece of a puzzle. It's not a miracle, and it doesn't replace all the other pieces, but it's one. And you need about 100 milligrams. 100 milligrams is a small amount. Remember, it takes 1,000 milligrams to make a gram, and it takes 28 grams to make an ounce. So you're talking about a little piece of chocolate each day, easily done, easily obtained, and beneficial. So we want to have as many antioxidants into our diet as possible, because every antioxidant has the capacity, more so with some than others, like alpha-lipoic acid, vitamin C, vitamin E, tocotrienols. These are superstar antioxidants because they'll go through your body, and with each loop through your body, about every 6 to 7 minutes, they will grab on to an electron, and a missing electron in the outer orbit of the free radical. And so it attaches to the ascorbate and neutralizes it. That's good. Hence, common sense and reason. What would be the outcome? It's simple. The more antioxidants that you take in food and beverages, like a fresh glass of orange juice in the morning, that would be terrific. Grape juice, also good. Beet juice, terrific. Increasing nitric oxide, increasing circulation, helping heal your arteries. Pomegranates. All of these supply some measure of ORAC, probably anywhere from 50 units to maybe 150. But realistically, the more ORAC you have, the greater the trapping of free radicals. The more free radicals you trap, the less damage to your cells. Let me give you an example. I just did a whole day workshop on this past week. And it was about looking at the average body, and depending upon your size and age, you could have anywhere from, let's say, we'll guesstimate 50 trillion to 75 trillion cells. Some people be more, others less. But now here's what we can pretty well know, based upon the science, that we have about 10,000 gene alterations per cell every 24 hours. So therefore, when you're looking at the average life expectancy, you have to take a lot of things into consideration. It is extremely complex. Genetics is one of them. Epigenetics is another. Because what went back about seven generations, and how did a person deal with life and relationships? Were they depressed, anxious, or were they calm? Were they positive or negative? All these things are locked into the epigenetics, which we take on when we're born. And that's why a lot of people, if they felt abandoned or they felt they need people, they're very needy, they need to be rescued, and they don't know why. It frequently is because at some level in the background, someone was abandoned. Someone didn't get the therapy or the treatment that they needed, or they didn't get the love and acceptance. Anyhow, all this in itself is a whole life science of the epigenetics of the cell, but it's in you. It's in all of us, in every cell. But then it's what we do to the cell. Do we honor the cell? Do we give it the nutrients it needs? Do we cleanse it out? Do we have a proper digestion system? Do we take our time eating? Do we eat in silence? Do we really masticate and create the bolus, the mass of food in our mouth that is completely insalivated with enzymes like ptyalin and amylase from under the tongue, so we really start digestion, especially breaking down complex carbohydrates, the polysaccharides, and the simple carbohydrate, the monosaccharide, so that we really absorb all the nutrients from that grain or complex grain or legume, etc. And then do we drink a hot or cold beverage with that particular meal? Do we fully masticate, or we just chew-chew, swallow, chew-chew, swallow, drink? All of this will make a difference. And our body will do the best it can to help us. But if you overload the stomach, if you had too much food in the stomach, and most Americans have way too much food, way too much, then what happens is the stomach gets so full, and then there's all kinds of sugars, and there's phosphoric acid from a soft drink, and the body doesn't know how to deal with it. So what does it do? It dumps it. You begin the dumping. A little flap opens up. You have two flaps. Cardiac sphincter lets it in. Pyloric sphincter lets it out. And then that goes into the intestine, top 12 inches to duodenum, and that tries to deacidify this mass. It's because it's mainly an alkaline medium throughout the rest of digestion. And then people don't do that. And as a result, they take in a lot of highly acidic foods, including coffee, and that's where we get a lot of our esophageal irritation from GERD, and we got a lot of intestinal inflammation from having highly acidic or alcoholic beverages in the diet. So now this food has been properly chewed where a person's relaxed, just being at ease, and now it goes in the intestine, and now the nutrients in there can be liberated. Because it's like, it's called chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. It's like a thick soup. And that's what food should be when it goes in the intestine, not these particles, a partially digested food, because they're not going to be absorbed. And then you've got these millions of little villi, and that's where a lot of this gets nutrient absorbed through these villi. Then it goes through the portal vein, goes into the liver, it's recombined in the liver, sent out into the blood, then it goes to the cells, and it nourishes the cells. That's an ideal process. Then you take the dead cells, you take the undigested ligo fiber, the cellulose, you take the bacteria, and that all is vacated, and you keep the intestine and the colon, you keep it cleansed of backup debris. And that's a healthy intestine, less likely to get colorectal cancer, polyps, diverticulitis, colitis, spastic colon, etc., that we have an epidemic of. You don't get the gas and bloating by overeating. You're eating the wrong combinations. Again, all this can be prevented if we do the right thing. And the more antioxidants you have, the more vegetables, fruits, and juices from those fruits and vegetables, the better your digestion, the better the absorption, and the higher degree of nutrients actually reaching the cells. But that's not how we eat. 93% approximately of Americans do not eat healthy. And as a result, we're the sickest nation in the world per population. And that's not a merit badge we need to put on our chest. That's just, it is so incomprehensible as to why people make these unhealthy choices consistently in knowing that there's not going to be a happy outcome. So, now you know why. If you want to help one part of this huge puzzle, just do one thing. Take some 70 or 80% cacao, small piece, little piece, and take it in each day. And like the clinical Journal of Clinical and Translational Science, you too could have an improvement in your skeletal muscle mitochondria. So you're not weak. Again, there's 1,000 more pieces. I just gave you one. Now, from Rush University's Medical Center, an article published in this week's British Medical Journal shows that a healthy habit improves longevity and prevents Alzheimer's disease. Yet, billions of dollars are being spent and have been spent on trying to find the magic drug that can be patented, with side effects, of course, but at least you'll have some of the cognition protected. Not a penny is spent, not a study is done. No national mandate of how we can prevent through lifestyle modification, because there's no profit in it. And the people that control the entirety of the medical industrial complex are doing so for the profit. And there's huge profits. How much? This year, about $3.8 trillion. We'll hit $4 trillion probably in the next 3 years. That's $4 trillion. And look what we get for it. We're dead last of developed nations in the world in healthcare outcomes in the United States. So there's where our logic is perfect. Listen carefully what I'm about to say so it makes sense. Our logic is that if we know that you have high blood pressure and there's a particular drug that can lower that blood pressure or prevent it from going higher, then the logic is take the pill in order to protect yourself from high blood pressure. The same is true for chemotherapy. If we know that we have 30 different chemotherapies that can treat, let's say, breast cancer, then use one of those or a combination along with other therapies like radiation or surgery if needed, and that will help with the cancer. The logic is perfect. Now, then you bring in your best doctors, oncologists, your best hospitals with the best diagnostics, and therefore the treatment should work. But it doesn't. 550,000 Americans died in the last year who went 100% in on orthodoxy, nothing alternative, and they died. Okay. Now, if someone saw that in 1 year, one-third of all patients died with serious cancers, then maybe someone should stop and re-examine the protocols. Maybe we're taking the wrong approach. But the logic is correct. If the scientists that we say are the smartest tell us that this is what should be used for treatment, and the doctors who are considered the smartest, going to Harvard and Yale and Columbia medical colleges, if they then have the best treatments from the best scientists and they're in the best hospitals with the best nurses and the best technology, then you should have the best outcome. You don't. You're the worst outcome. And then you think, well, hold on a second. Maybe something in this chain is wrong, but there's no reflection. You have to have introspection before you have reflection. You have to have the capacity to not honor illusion of outcome, but the reality of outcome. And we don't do that in our society. So nobody ever apologizes for someone dying. Nobody gives back the money for treatments that were deemed unfit, like Paxil and other treatments that can cause serious side effects. And about 90% of our drugs have very serious side effects. So you see, we're using a logic instead of reason. We're using a consensual science based upon a profit and capitalist motive instead of humanistic science that looks for how can we first do no harm and then prevent a disease in the first place. But no one is using logic to say, shouldn't we try to prevent a disease rather than just treat it? And the answer is, of course we should. But that mindset has been long gone. It was there with Hippocrates, and it certainly was there with Maimonides. But it's not there today. It doesn't exist today. That's the simple reality. And it's systemic. It's the entire medical industrial complex, the scientific complex. So what no one's looking at is what is the most appropriate way to prevent and what is the most appropriate way to treat. And no one is given that choice. To do so, you risk your license or you risk your reputation or you risk no longer having funding. Just want to share that with you. So here the Russian University Medical Center is saying healthy lifestyles prevent Alzheimer's. And that's what they said. It was published in the British Medical Journal. In fact, a study that was published found that people ages 65 and older who had a healthy lifestyle live longer, 5.7 years longer for women, 3.1 years for men, than their peers who didn't have the same healthy lifestyle. They also spent more of the remaining years without Alzheimer's disease. Now, shouldn't that be something big because there's no drug ever invented that can add years on to Alzheimer's? None. And there won't ever be any because these people are as dumb as bricks. They're greedy as hell. They're dumb as bricks, and they have no common sense. This is the big stupid in the middle of the room that's 4,000 pounds and nobody wants to acknowledge it exists. How can this person be stupid? Smart people do smart things. Good people do good things. Wrong. Judge a person by what they do, not by their background, not by the false image that we want to paint on them, and you'll see a different outcome. So, this should be promoted in every medical center, every college, every medical teaching curriculum, every hospital, every doctor's office, every nurse's curriculum in America. Healthy habits improve longevity, including preventing Alzheimer's. Nothing will happen to this study. It'll be there. It'll be gone. One of thousands in the same mindset. Good study. Well done. Nobody pays attention to it. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Anall. We're going to take a break. And we've got some really interesting discussion topics today. First up, the person responsible for misdirecting the entire COVID pandemic is Robert Gallo. He worked with Robert Gallo. And this was Margaret Heckler with Robert Gallo. But at the same time, I'm going to play first a clip from Anthony Fauci from 1985. Listen carefully what he's saying. He's saying that a child could get AIDS, HIV infection, just by being around someone who has it. It's not true. It's a complete lie. And yet, that's how a whole nation was captured in a false medical narrative that everybody could get AIDS and everybody could die. Wasn't true then. It's not true now. And for those of us, myself included, who actually were working with people, I worked with 1,200 people at one time, all of who had full-blown AIDS and reversed every condition, but 18 of those, we reversed the disease itself. They seroconverted, got their health back. That was never acknowledged. In fact, I was attacked because I cured AIDS. Because if I was able to cure AIDS with intravenous vitamin C drips and intravenous ozone and herbs and homeopathic and zeolites and de-stressing, well, that's easy. No, we want a vaccine and we want a drug. Vaccine didn't come, the drug did, AZT. And look at the consequences of HIV positive, but otherwise healthy people taking a known DNA terminator, so toxic that it was invented at the National Cancer Institute, and the guy, quote, threw it on the junk heap of science because it was too toxic even for terminally ill cancer patients to have it. Yet Anthony Fauci found it very good, and it was deadly. 1,800 milligrams a day. Anyone giving that would lose their medical license day. Why has the media never had a retrospective on how bad this guy has been, how dangerous of a human being he is to society, how wrong he was then, how wrong he has been today? So when we come back, we're going to hear Anthony Fauci in his own words, not mine. Remember, everything I say in this show, I can document. Over the weekend, I sent over 300 pieces of information to the program director, the station manager, a former head of the National Pacifica Board, local boards, the information that I'm using on this program. You can go there and see all this for yourself every day under the footnotes. All right? This is Fauci in his own words. How wrong he was, and the consequences of him being wrong are deadly. Back in a moment.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you, let me give my life to you, let me drown in your laughter, let me die. Let me always be with you.
We may be starting to see, as we're seeing virtually as the months go by, other groups that can be involved, and seeing it in children is really quite disturbing.
When you say other close contact, give me some examples.
Well, for example, if the close contact of a child is a household contact, perhaps there will be a certain number of cases of individual who are just living with and in close contact with someone with AIDS or at risk of AIDS who does not necessarily have to have intimate sexual contact or share a needle, but just the ordinary close contact that one sees in normal interpersonal relationships. We may be...
Okay, that's a lie. It's a lie within incredible dangerous consequences. As a result, people, even family members, would wear masks and gloves and gowns, dress up completely so that they wouldn't get infected with AIDS or HIV from being around someone who had HIV infection or AIDS. In my office, I got my medical staff together, all the board-certified physicians and nurses, nurse practitioners, and Dr. Margaret R., holistic dentist, everyone. And I said, I do not want you working with a person with AIDS unless you're going to treat them as a human being. This is not an airborne infection, and therefore you have nothing to fear working with them. And so as a result, everybody was treated in a comfortable way. I would sit and hold people's hands, and they were shocked. You know, why are you without a mask? Or why are you holding my hands? Because you're here to be helped, and we want to show that you're not infected. You're not going to spread HIV in the air. That's a myth. And as a result, people enjoyed coming there to get treatment because they were treated respectfully and holistically, and not a single one died. Not one. But no one wanted to know that story. To this day, nobody wants to know it. That's unfortunate. But there's the most award-winning documentary in the world this year by the Society for Independent Investigative Journalists did a documentary on this called The Cost of Denial. Look at it. You'll see the truth. But here's the second part of this. Everything we were told at the beginning was also a lie. Here is the top health person in America, Margaret Heckler. Beside her, you see Robert Gallo. This was a 1984 press conference. It's only 38 seconds long, but this opened a door for massive corruption, exploitation, falsifying science, treatments that did not work, an antibody test that did not work. But here's what they're saying. Listen to what they're saying in their own words, not mine.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First, the probable cause of AIDS has been found, a variant of a known human cancer virus. Second, not only has the agent been identified, but a new process has been developed to mass produce this virus. Thirdly, with discovery of both the virus and this new process, we now have a blood test for AIDS. With the blood test, we can identify AIDS victims with essentially 100% certainty.
Thanks, Secretary.
Okay. Everything she said was a lie. Number one, did you hear her say the probable cause of AIDS? Where were the scientific papers at the time proving it? Here's what we found. Here's what was discovered by a wonderful and extraordinarily brilliant and courageous journalist, Janine Roberts. She was the one who found the story on blood diamonds. She was the one who found the story in Australia about Native children being taken away and put in orphanages and not allowed to teach their own language or learn any other historical notions of life. All these stories she broke. And she came to me. She came up to the center and she said, I'd like to show you some documents. And so I'm looking at a document. It's all scribbled through. And she said, that's Robert Gallo. The scribbles are his. Now look at the original document. And I said, tell me what I'm looking at. She said, this was the head of the Gallo lab at the National Cancer Institute, and he did not find, nor did the head of the electron microscope division of the National Cancer Institute find an HIV virus. In fact, here's what the head of the laboratory said. Debris, cellular debris. Okay? And then in the article, it did not show that there was a unique HIV virus that was the cause of AIDS. It didn't show that. So I said, so how'd this happen? Well, Gallo was over at the Institute of Pasteur, I believe she said, trying to sell them on his antibody detection test. When he came back, and this was about to go to Science Magazine, he went, you know, out of his way to change everything. The changed one was what was published. So all you had to have is an original from the head of the institute, or his top person, to show that he had altered it. Well, she managed, the director of the institute, managed to take a copy of the original one, the one he wrote, unedited, that showed there was nothing there that would cause this, and he gave it to a relative. I believe it was his sister in Europe. Janine got it from the sister in Europe. How she found out about this, I don't know, but she did. She was one of the best investigative journalists in world history. Now, hundreds of scientists have found this and looked at it, and they wrote a letter to Science Magazine asking for it to be retracted. They refused to retract it. So 3,000 of the greatest scientists, physicians, and journalists, including multiple Nobel Prize winners, petitioned that this was corrupt. Nothing happened. The media wouldn't touch the story. Now go to the second misinformation. Oh, this will be a 100% accurate test. To the contrary, we can thank a woman named Johnson who did the research, a science writer, who found that when you get the HIV antibody test, first look at the instructions. Look at the, it says right there, this is not to be a test to determine if you're HIV infected. It's testing for an antibody. So now, instead of being 100% gold standard that it would only give a positive result if you had HIV, instead she found that if you have measles, if you've had the flu, if you've had the flu vaccine, if you have hepatitis, if you have herpes, yeah, if you've had malaria, if you had tuberculosis, if you were pregnant, all these different conditions, over 80 different conditions, if you had those, you could test positive for HIV. In other words, you don't have HIV because these are cross-reacting in the blood. So you were getting a false positive reading. But no, nobody was allowed to challenge, just like today. Nobody was allowed to challenge PCR test, which is complete fraud. And no one was allowed to challenge Gallo's test. But just to let you know that what you thought was accurate science and treatment and history wasn't. Now, a lot of people are asking me, Gary, what's going on? What's this great reset? Well, Canada's leading the way in this, as Canada just brought out later in the show I'm going to deal with this, Canada just brought out the new card. They're already running with the idea that everybody should not only be vaccinated, but have a card that puts everything about their identity on one card. This is the beginning of the Great Reset in Canada. So what else is going on with the Great Reset? Two things. One, people are going to be dealing with your money. That's part of it. And especially since we're loaded with debt beyond our capacity to repay, we're a bankrupt nation. So how do you get out of all that debt? You centralize it so that everything, all the debt goes into one computer system of one entity that is controlled by special interest groups, and then you forgive it. But in the process, you control everyone else's life at every level. Here is a person explaining this. This is Melissa Simuni. She's from Ireland, and she's the best person I know of anywhere to explain this. This is important. Please listen carefully.
Lockdowns do work. Not at stopping the spread of a virus, but they're successful at destroying economies. This virus is statistically as devastating to the population as a bad flu. So why have the governments implemented and hailed such a disproportionate response, destroying their economies and pretending that it doesn't matter? It's because COVID is the scapegoat and an excuse or an opportunity to bring about their great reset. QE started in 2008 following the banking crisis caused by misuse of the lending markets, and the economy has been on life support ever since. In September 2019, a month before Bill Gates' Event 201, the overnight money market seized. The Federal Reserve had to step in, printing $50 to $100 million per night to try and fix it. But there was no fixing it. Since COVID, they have expanded the money supply by between 20 to 25% under the guise of COVID relief, rather than what is another banking crisis. History tells us this money printing ends with the collapse of the currency and the economy it is attached to. Since 1971, when the dollar as the reserve currency came off the gold standard, all currencies have been fiat. They are backed by nothing and dependent on faith Only 3% of the money supply is physical notes and coins. The other 97% is debt-based. Debt brings money into existence. You borrow $100,000 and the banks are allowed to create that money from the ether and loan it to you with interest. In the reverse case, it's important that you know that when you deposit money into a bank, it no longer belongs to you. The banks can legally invest 90% of it and they provide you with interest for this. In 2008, we saw bank bailouts. But as of 2014, Ireland and the UK have agreed to bank bail-ins instead, meaning they can legally take your money in a crisis. This is what happened in Cyprus in 2013. The government claims to guarantee a certain amount of deposits, but only hold less than 0.5%. So good luck getting your money back. So the credit markets are under stress. What is the best pressure release valve for the credit markets? To hold back a collapse. It's a weaker economy. This could be part of the reason the economy was shut down. The difficulty they now face in opening back up is when you combine an increase in money supply with an increase in velocity, you're inviting inflation. In 2008, QE was given to the banking sector and large corporations, but in 2020, it was also given to the general public, readily available now to spend. By keeping sectors of the economy closed, you're breaking the velocity. Velocity is the number of times the same amount of money changes hands. An increased velocity will lead to inflation, but it isn't essential for it. Couple this with the inevitable increased demand for debt when the economy does open back up, and people are taking out loans again, and this could pop the debt bubble. This financial system is held together with debt. When you buy a loaf of bread, there could be 10 different transactions of credit to get it to your door between manufacturers, suppliers, and distributors. Mathematically, credit is doomed to break, and this will seize the entire economy. This is why the banks were considered too big to fail. If credit isn't functioning, then products won't be created. When the credit market fails, so does the entire economy. So what do they do? Inflation is inevitable. More money is chasing the same amount of goods and services. That's just how money works. It has been evident in property for a long time, but is recently showing up in commodity prices like lumber, copper, and also in food prices. Inflation initially raises asset prices and then filters down into living costs. The last to inflate is wages, making it increasingly difficult for the less wealthy to buy property, as their wages only meet their living expenses. The government have got themselves into overwhelming debt, so they can't raise interest rates, or they won't be able to service that debt, as they can barely meet the interest requirements. It seems they are planning to let inflation rise, trying to maintain some control over it and inflate away the debt. Inflation is a hidden tax. Just as they inflate away the debt, they inflate away your purchasing power, and you slowly lose everything you've worked for. With inflation and bank bail-ins, they're taking your money. The danger here is hyperinflation, if control and faith are lost. Look at Venezuela and Zimbabwe, where currency litters the streets and it has so little purchasing power that it isn't even worth picking up. We are moving into a central bank digital currency. This has already been rolled out in China, with Sweden, Turkey and Iran following. With digital currency, the government have complete control, as it is programmable. It is a loss of your freedom and privacy. They can control velocity by programming it with expiry dates or deciding where in the economy can be spent. They can limit your leisure spending, prohibit you from buying certain items, or only allow spending on basic food items and rent. They can tax and fine directly. They have control. They can incentivize you to spend or save with negative or positive interest rates, respectively. How would you implement a control agenda? I would collapse the economy so that there's no independent businesses, therefore making everyone dependent on the state. I'd provide them with a generous universal credit system, then slowly reduce it or inflate it away. The concept of UBI has been about for some years now. Over 80% of jobs that make moderate to low wages are predicted to be automated away by 2030. Humans are becoming surplus to requirement. In the fourth industrial revolution, according to the World Economic Forum, our bodies will be so high-tech we won't be able to distinguish between what's natural and what's artificial. A future of superhumans. It's frightening. They're also proponents of the green energy carbon tax movement, which, if you look into it, is eugenics repackaged. They're telling us that if we pay more taxes and stop eating meat, it will cool down the planet. The middle and working classes will be eroded and replaced with robots, AI and big corporations, and given a basic income. So how's this funded? The Davos IMF concept is that you will own nothing and be happy. So is the idea to confiscate or severely limit all private property? The other option is taxes, but the rich don't pay taxes. The loopholes are designed to be beneficial to them but too costly for us. While a universal basic income is proposed, the more effective solution to stop the wealth divide would be a universal maximum income with a wealth cap. Let them have 20 million. That's a lot of money. They can buy all the houses and yachts that they want. But it would limit their amount of control and influence. This is the biggest heist of wealth transfer in history. The media does not inform you. Its purpose is to distract and advertise to you. The economy has collapsed under the weight of debt-fueled greed, and the media are silent. Billionaires have increased their wealth by 28% during the crisis, gained at the expense of small businesses. The stock market is fake, and it is a rigged game, fueled by money printing and doomed to crash. The old world is not coming back. A group of billionaires are deciding how the rest of the world should live, and they have the ear of the government that claims to represent you. When you hear Johnston, Trudeau and Biden say build back better, that is a Davos concept, a collection of non-elected private billionaire influencers. If we submit to a digital currency, we lose control and privacy. This is what you really need to wake up to. Furlough is psychological prepping for UBI. You are not being paid to stay at home. You are being paid not to revolt. If you know that pounds, dollars, etc. are losing purchasing power, why would you keep them? This is why people are moving to hold assets such as silver, gold, land and property instead and transferring currency to crypto to outrun the inflation that is already becoming evident. There's also a ridiculous increase in shipping costs. COVID impacted the supply chain. China stockpiled containers and the system broke. This led to a problem with stock on shelves. When it is fully operational again, the additional costs will be passed on to the consumer. It would be wise to buy supplies to combat any shortages while the system resets. Better looking at them than looking for them. Hold gold, silver, crypto to maintain a degree of autonomy from the upcoming digital system. I am not a financial advisor. I would advise you to do your own research and find what works for you. The problem is our fiat currency is failing. Thousands have preceded it and they've all failed due to debasement of the currency. We have to be aware of this so we can prepare and work to fight against the oncoming erosion of our freedom and of our privacy.
Well said. Important information. Telling the truth, something you won't hear the dancing heads over at CNN and any other places say because they're controlled by the narrative given to them by the corporate interests behind it. Now, that's only one. But for those of you who may not be fully aware of what the new reset, the fourth industrial revolution, really portends for you, I want to share another of these important commentaries. This one is from, a terrifying prediction. Where is it? I had it here a moment ago. It's from a different person. I'll find out more on her in a moment, but let's go to what she has to say. I think you'll find it important.
Today, I am going to be speaking about what I believe could be the three main pillars that surround the World Economic Forum's agenda for 2030 and discussing some of the things that they are promoting around the now famous event called the Great Reset. Before I start, though, I just want you to keep two things in mind. Number one, the World Economic Forum and the leader, Klaus Schwab, haven't been elected by anyone. Yet despite this fact, they are trying to influence politics all around the world in order to transform the planet that we live on. Secondly, all of the resources that I'm sharing sharing in this video are coming from verifiable sources, many of which are directly from the WEF's website. If you want to confirm any of the information, there is more info in the description. So let us discuss the three hypothetical pillars and how it might affect our lives. Pillar one, surveillance. The first pillar in the 2030 agenda is the possibility of total surveillance of every single one of us. And the way the WEF could achieve this is by us requiring a new form of identification. The World Economic Forum suggests that every single person on the planet will receive a new form of digital ID, which they say would help promote a world of inclusion where everyone has more access to basic services. But they also suggest this ID could be linked to absolutely everything in your life. It could be required to book plane and train tickets and track where it is you're going. This digital ID would be needed to access social media, the internet, bank accounts, and even a requirement in order to spend your money. And without your ID, it's possible you may not be able to buy anything at all. And who would control your digital ID and the data it contains? Well, of course, your government would. In short, absolutely every action you take in your modern life could be tracked by this new type of personal ID. What your online habits are, where you go, what you buy online, what you say online, and so much more. And if you think this kind of a system is a little bit worrying, well, you're not the only one that thinks this way. Just recently, Kenya's High Court ruled a digital ID system to be illegal in the country because they fear it could be abused by the government in order to violate a person's basic right to privacy. But the WEF doesn't agree. They think it's going to do more good than harm. But anyway, where would you be carrying this new form of ID? Well, according to the WEF, you could be carrying it inside your body. In his book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, Schwab talks heavily about how RFID chips could be used to track goods and packages around the world, enabling our economy to become significantly more efficient. But in referencing the same technology, he also said this: in the near future, similar monitoring systems will also be applied to the movement and tracking of people. He also says that the fourth industrial revolution will lead to a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities. Echoing this on the website, the WEF discusses a future where electronic implants could become a relatively normal part of human life. Lastly, I want to mention something I've spoken about on this channel before, which is in regards to the WEF's potential forecast for a future of surveillance, which comes from an article published on Forbes, which is written by a WEF contributor. The article is titled, Welcome to 2030. I own nothing, have no privacy, and life has never been better. And the line I want to highlight is as follows. Once in a while, I get annoyed about the fact that I have no real privacy, nowhere I can go and not be registered. I know somewhere everything I do, think, and dream of is recorded. I just hope that nobody will use it against me. To be clear, this article was written by Ida Auken, who is a Danish politician and also a member of the WEF, writing as a contributor for the World Economic Forum. So this is pillar number one, surveillance. And later on, I'm going to be talking about how the world of surveillance ties in with pillar three. But for now, let's talk about the second pillar, which is finance. Pillar two, finance. The next pillar of the Great Reset agenda could be around finance, and more specifically, putting more control of money and assets in the hands of the government. So you know the line, you will own nothing and you will be happy? Well, this is the pillar where this could be playing out. In multiple articles on their own website and elsewhere, the WEF predicts a world where people will no longer own most of the things they use in life. Instead, through a sharing economy, items like clothing and cooking equipment will be owned by your government and delivered to you when you need them. But according to a WEF member, sometimes you won't even need to decide what you need because an algorithm that knows your tastes better than you do could make these choices for you instead. And your home? Well, soon that could be owned by the government as well. But you won't have to pay rent because someone else will be using your space when you're not there. In short, everything that you own now could soon hypothetically be owned by your government. But the most important tool, asset, that you have, which we use every single day to exchange value, value, which is money, seems that the WEF might have a plan for that as well. The WEF talks heavily about how cash in the modern world is risky and how it should be replaced by digital money. And even though statistics show that many countries around the world would prefer to use cash over electronic forms of money, the WEF believes these people just don't know what's good for them. Instead, they believe we should all be switching over to electronic payment systems as it's the way of the future. So, what could replace a world where we no longer have any kind of physical money? Well, the next step would be to develop a secure digital currency that everybody can use. It's kind of like crypto, except the future digital currency proposed wouldn't be decentralized. It would be completely controlled by your government. And this is called the Central Bank Digital Currency, or CBDC. A CBDC would be fully trackable, traceable, and a secure form of currency that, like Bitcoin, lives on a blockchain. But it would be also fully centralized. There would be money controlled by those in power instead of being in the hands of the people. With a CBDC, your money would no longer be held in a bank account either. Instead, proposals suggest cutting out what they call the middleman, with your government becoming the bank that directly holds your money for you. Nations like United States, Brazil, China, Canada, Germany, Austria, and Australia are already at certain stages of research or developing a CBDC, meaning we may be only a couple of years away from this becoming a reality. But potentially most worrying of all, a CBDC would also be fully programmable, meaning your government could place whatever rules they wanted on your money, potentially allowing you to only spend your money on the items that they deem appropriate, or even worse, cutting off your access to your money altogether. In short, it would become the perfect tool in order to track and control your money, the very thing that we need in order to survive in today's world. If you want to learn more, I've recently made a video about CBDCs. Feel free to watch that one after you watch this one. Now, let's move on to pillar three. But before I do, I want to talk about today's sponsor, which still has a very heavy focus on decentralized money that is firmly in the hands of the people. A part of my diversification strategy for growing my wealth is to invest in crypto, and recently I've started using FTX as my preferred way of doing so. One of my biggest peeves with buying crypto is the massive fees that many exchanges charge, sometimes up to 5%, but this is not the case with FTX. Via the FTX app, you can buy and sell crypto and NFTs with absolutely no fees. Even better, by using the FTX app, you'll also earn free crypto on every trade you make over $10. I love that I can also set up recurring investments, so I get to choose how much money I'd like to invest, and then the app will automatically buy the crypto for me at predetermined intervals I choose, so whether every day, every month, every week. They also have a crypto debit card and a trading platform for more advanced traders. Over 6 million people trust FTX to buy, sell, and hold crypto, and it is for customers of the US as well as people from around the world. If you'd like to get started today creating a crypto portfolio with FTX, there is a link below this video. Pillar 3, scoring. Finally, the last part of the WEF's hypothetical plan for 2030 is scoring, basically ranking human beings against each other based on almost every single action that they take. And this is called the social credit system. Simply put, it is judging how good or bad of a citizen you are based on almost every single thing that you do in your day-to-day life, rewarding people who are doing things that the government likes and punishing people that do the opposite. Sounds depressing? Well, there is already one place on Earth that has implemented this system.
China.
Today, China has already the world's most restrictive social credit system. It's a system where citizens are ranked based on almost everything they do in day-to-day life, from how long they play video games to how well they drive, what their shopping habits are, and whether they buy too many luxury items, and especially what they say online, as well as who they associate with. If a person's score gets too low, they can lose access to things in life that many of us would argue are human rights, things like a passport, bank loans, or access to putting their children in a good school. And if your score gets low enough, there are even reports the governments can come and take your dog away. Only a few years ago, China was already banning upwards of 20 million people a year from buying a plane or train ticket because their social credit score was too low. And guess who is a big fan of China's system and the country's current leader? You guessed it, this guy. Klaus Schwab recently gave China's president a glowing introduction at World Economic Forum event and praised Xi's leadership as well as his nation's economic achievements. Don't like the idea of a credit score? Well, unfortunately, they soon could be coming to a country near you. The first social credit system in Europe is set to begin rolling out in Italy later this year. And the Australian city of Darwin has also proposed one as well. A social credit system like this would neatly slot in with the surveillance pillar, and it would make the scoring of every individual very easy, because if we all have digital IDs, we could easily be scored on our every action. Now, I personally believe that the very idea of a social credit system is disgusting. Pinning humans against each other and ranking them based on their behavior? No, thank you. But whether you feel as strongly about this issue as I do or not, there is one thing that really can't be argued with, that a system like this would eventually mean that the government would control the people and how they live. It would mean that people would have to act the way that the government would want them to act. And those that don't toe the line, they would lose their rights and privileges, financial privileges, economic privileges, and basic human freedoms. To me, this sounds like the perfect way of controlling a population and removing everybody's individual free will. But hey, maybe that's just me. I'd love to know your thoughts. The conclusion. In the end, these three hypothetical pillars seem...
Okay, that was Sorelle, S-O-R-E-L-L-E, Amore, A-M-O-R-E. And she's in finance. We didn't catch that last little ad. All these clips have ads in them. Just to give you my perspective, I'm against all cryptocurrencies. There's nothing backing them up. It's all a foolish and irresponsible game. And just in the last week alone, cryptocurrencies, many of them lost up anywhere from 50 to 75% of their value. That means...
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Monday, May 16th. Here are some headlines. On Saturday, a white gunman shot and killed 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. The Tops Friendly Market, where the shooting took place, is located in the heart of Buffalo's black community, and 11 of the 13 people shot were black. 18-year-old Peyton Gendron was arrested on the scene and charged with first-degree murder, and the FBI is investigating the shooting as a hate crime and an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Details are emerging of a racist manifesto allegedly written by Gendron, who is suspected of traveling nearly 200 miles from his home to attack a predominantly black neighborhood. He is currently under suicide watch. President Joe Biden is scheduled to travel to Buffalo tomorrow to meet with the families of victims, the White House said. And over the weekend, Representative Liz Cheney called on fellow Republican leaders to reject views of white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism, warning that, quote, history has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse, close quote. Gun violence also plagued the Southern California city of Laguna Woods yesterday after a shooting at a church left at least one person dead and five others injured. The shooting occurred at the Geneva Presbyterian Church during an event to honor a former pastor of a Taiwanese congregation that uses the church for its worship services. Police have a suspect in custody. He is believed to be an Asian man in his 60s who doesn't live in the area. The suspect was detained after a group of churchgoers were able to hogtie his legs with an extension cord and confiscate at least two handguns from him. Investigators are working to determine whether he has any connections to the church or its congregants. Police do not yet have a motive. A new analysis reveals that nearly 80 million properties in the United States stand a significant chance of exposure to wildfire, according to a model built by the nonprofit First Street Foundation. A Washington Post analysis of the group's data found that an estimated 16% of the country's population today lives in hazardous areas. Over the next 30 years, that share will increase to 21%. Nearly half of all Americans who live in areas vulnerable to fire will reside in the South, and minorities face a disproportionate risk. Wildfires are becoming more severe and frequent because of human-caused climate change. Record-breaking heat and drought fueled by increasing greenhouse gas emissions are drying out grasslands and forests and lengthening the fire season. And Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson announced Sunday that her party, the Social Democrats, had decided that Sweden should join NATO. The party voted in a Sunday meeting to support working toward applying to join the Western Military Alliance, setting up a vote in Parliament. Hours earlier, Finland formally announced it will seek to join NATO. Andersson said Sweden's military non-alliance had served it well for 200 years, but Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine showed the policy, quote, will not serve us well in the future, close quote. The invasion demonstrated that the Kremlin is prepared to use violence to achieve their political objectives and that they don't hesitate to take enormous risks, Andersson said. Turkey, which is a member of NATO, has voiced concern over Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance, but it is not expected to veto their membership. President Vladimir Putin said today that there was no threat to Russia if Sweden and Finland joined NATO, but cautioned that Moscow would respond if the U.S.-led alliance bolstered military infrastructure.